Well, hello, my friends. This is CK from the Mirths and Monsters podcast, proud partner of the Odd Audio Network. Join me, my companion Finn, and my occasionally satanically possessed cat Ray,
Puny Mortals,
as we investigate the real truths behind some of the most wonderful creatures you can imagine. Are trolls really that thick? Or is it just bad press? Are leprechauns really drunken bums? Sort of. But there's a lot more to find out. All you need to do is tune in to Mirths and Monsters podcast with me and Finn. Till next time, slancha, your good health.
Hey there, this is Erica Kelly, and you're listening to Southern Fried True Crime. I hope you enjoyed the trailer for my friend CK over at Mirths and Monsters. Even for the most devoted true crime fan, sometimes you need a break from the darkness, and I find his show to be a delightful palate cleanser. I do hope you'll check it out. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. On February 14, 2013, a single father named J.D. Shreves dropped off his daughters to see their grandmother for Valentine's Day. When he got back to the house, he thought he smelled something burning. He walked around but couldn't find the source, so he thought he was imagining things. When the girls got back, they said they smelled something too. Now JD took his flashlight and went outside to check around. He found that a piece of siding had been pulled back and someone had stuffed a lit piece of cloth into the boards behind it. As his girls cried and he frantically called 911, it hit him that this was done on purpose. And whoever had done it had to have been watching him, because he only left the house for about half an hour. He'd been lucky that the cloth was small and that the winds were on his side. Instead of a blaze, it was only smoldering. His house wasn't the first to be lit in a series of fires in Accomack County, Virginia, but it was the first home where people still lived. It was fire number 44. And the only one that wasn't set on an abandoned property. That should have been a major clue, but the authorities didn't connect the dots until later, and the arsonist kept terrorizing the area until April 1st. Happy Valentine's Day, and welcome to Episode 13, Burning Love, the Accomack County Arsonist. Accomack County is located on the eastern edge of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Along with Northampton County, it makes up the eastern shore of Virginia, which is part of the Delmarva Peninsula, bordered by Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean. English explorers landed there in 1603, 4 years before Jamestown was settled. The name comes from the Native American word Accomack, which meant on the other side. Probably because it was on the peninsula on the other side of the mainland. It is named for the Accomack Indians who lived there when the English first landed. The tribes were soon forced to sell to the English, and in 1642 the name was changed to Northampton, following a policy of eliminating so-called heathen names. But Northampton was divided into two counties in 1663, with the northern part of the county taking back the name Accomack. The county is a little over 1,300 square miles, or 3,400 kilometers, but over 65% of that is water. The northern border of the eastern shore is the Maryland state line, and there is a gas station called Dixieland with a big old sign that reads, "The South Starts Here." Perhaps unsurprisingly, the county was Confederate at the beginning of the Civil War, but it was occupied by Union troops early on. Before that, for 200 years, the land was cultivated for potatoes and tomatoes by white farmers and their slaves, who made up a third of the county's population. African Americans still comprise about 30% of the population there today. In the late 1880s, the railroad came to the Eastern Shore and brought an economic boom with it. Annual crop sales on the Eastern Shore went from about $750,000 to almost $2 million in the next 20 years. By 1910, Accomack and Northampton were two of the wealthiest rural counties in America. In the early 20s, the invention of automobiles transformed the Eastern Shore again. Farmers bought their own trucks, made their own deals, and drove the crop value way down. By 1928, many formerly wealthy farmers were not even able to cover their production costs, and then the Depression struck the next year. You could say that the area has never recovered. Certainly, Accomack and Northampton are the poorest counties in the Commonwealth to this day. In the 1920s, Arthur Perdue changed his family's egg farm into a farm that exclusively raised broiler chickens. He saw that the land that had been so ripe for potatoes and tomatoes was also the perfect climate for raising chickens. By the late 60s, Perdue opened its first mass-market factory there, and by 2012, Perdue and Tyson were the two biggest employers in Accomack County. These companies employed about 15,000 people, with only about 1,300 of those being actual farmers. The rest were low-paying factory positions, catching crews, slaughtering teams, and then the more assembly line work of deboning, trussing, and lastly, the janitorial and maintenance jobs. One could hope to make around $9 to $12 an hour in these positions, with little hope of advancement. But there was some consolation in that they were working steady jobs, unlike the rest of the country, which had just lived through the Great Recession. So by November of 2012, where our story starts, the rural communities of the Eastern Shore of Virginia had suffered the same fates of those across the country. Family farms were replaced by huge corporate factories, and what would be considered the middle class in that area was surviving on what urban areas would consider to be well under the poverty level of income. It was a large, dark, and empty area, deserted farmland with a lot of abandoned houses. On the evening of November 12th, Deborah Clark was startled by her neighbor banging on her door, yelling that the house across the field was on fire. First, she ran next door to her niece's double wide, warning her that she was closer to the fields around the house. This time of year, there was nothing but dry grass, so it was going up quickly. Deborah ran back inside and called 911, breathlessly telling the dispatcher, "Someone done set the house on fire on Dennis Drive." The dispatcher asked for the address, but Deborah didn't know it. She just kept saying, "That big house, that empty house." The 911 operator was asking the normal questions, trying to make sure no one was in the house or needed medical assistance, but she couldn't see what Deborah could see, and that was the fire spreading quickly to the field and edging closer to the yards of the surrounding mobile homes. The call came in at 10:41 p.m. All fire stations in Accomack County are operated by volunteers. It's policy that at least four stations respond to any call to make sure there's enough pressurized water at the scene, as most residents use well water. This is a very rural area. There aren't streetlights for miles of stretches out on country roads. Most towns in the county don't have a municipal water supply, so there are no fire hydrants. The firefighters had to bring the water and could quickly run out if the fire was big. Volunteer firefighters brought water in huge tankers that held 2,500 gallons. The four closest fire departments were dispatched, with Chief Phil Kelly and the Parksley Fire Department taking the lead. Named as first due, meaning they were the closest station, so first on scene and bringing an ambulance. The dispatcher also gave the dreaded notification to all stations that the fire was fully involved, which meant the structure was engulfed and flames were already leaping. Fully involved is really bad. It's not something a firefighter wants to hear before they are even on scene. Chief Kelly answered the call at 10:44, confirming he was on the way. But Station 6 in Bloxham actually made it to the scene first. When Chief Kelly got to the scene, he immediately worried if they would have enough water. He was an experienced firefighter and worked for NASA off the Accomack coast on Wallops Island with a team responsible for rocket launch equipment. Kelly radioed dispatch and asked what tankers were on the way, relieved to hear that two more were coming. The nearby town of Tasley had a tanker and another fire engine driven by their chief, Jeff Beal. Chief Beal was one of the other few firefighters employed by NASA and was good friends with Kelly. Now, with three tankers and more than a dozen men and women there to fight the fire, they attacked the fire where it was the strongest, hoping the house would collapse in on itself, helping to stop it from spreading. The 911 dispatcher radioed back to Kelly and advised him that they were now 15 minutes into the incident. This is important, as each firefighter only carries 45 minutes worth of oxygen on their backs. And even more important, at this scene, where the tanker from Blomix was already empty and the tanker from Tasley was almost dry, "We're out of water," grimly went through all the headsets as Chief Kelly tried to make a plan. Kelly had an empty tanker switch places with the last full one, and the empty one went to go refill. And the firefighters repeated this complicated transition as each tanker went dry. Soon the dispatcher was notifying Kelly that he was 30 minutes into the incident. But now both of the other tankers had been refilled, and all three were surrounding the house. Surround and drown was now the war cry, and finally, right at the 45-minute mark, Kelly saw that the smoke coming off the house was now a mist, meaning they had finally gotten the worst of the fire, the seed, put out. Finally, with the fire out, the only light was from the trucks and headlamps as they walked the perimeter of the scene. In the darkness, they couldn't find anything suspicious, and Chief Kelly called into dispatch around 1 a.m. and said terminating command, indicating that they were leaving the scene for the night. All three departments drove wearily back to their stations. The Tasley crew were just hanging up their hats when another 911 call came in at 1:30 a.m. It was Helen Hasty, whose home was on the old Smith Brothers farm that had a bunch of deserted migrant camps. This was one of the old family farms that had been pushed out by the corporations, and the migrant camps lay empty as a result. Helen had walked outside to see why her dog was barking, and saw the night sky lit up in orange. She called 911, explaining that the camps were over 100 years old, but deserted. She was growing more upset and told the operator that the fire was now on both sides of the road, and then cried out, "Oh my God, there she goes," as she watched the old camps become completely engulfed. Less than 8 minutes later, another call came into 911 dispatch. This time, the caller said they were on Arthur Lane. The Tasley department were now the first due on scene, and they weren't even finished putting up their equipment from the Dennis Drive fire before they were redressing and jumping back on the truck. The Arthur Lane fire was reported to be in the woods, so Chief Beal notified dispatch to call the forestry department. The Blomix fire crew was just leaving the first scene at Dennis Drive when they were called out to the one at Helen Hasty's property. The Parksley crew, led by Chief Kelly, was also called out there. Now, two fires in one night is not unheard of, but it is highly unusual. But three? Chief Kelly put in a call to a friend that was a special agent with the Virginia State Police named Glenn Neal. He was specifically trained in fire and bomb investigations. He asked his friend if he knew what was going on out there, and Neal responded that he was already on it before he hung up the phone. It was a long night in Accomack County. The whispers were already starting. "We've got an arsonist." And in less than 24 hours, the fires would start again. At 9:41 p.m. on November 13th, the next night, a fire at another abandoned house in Greenbush was called in. Then, at 10:45 p.m., fire number 5 was called in from yet another empty house in Parksley. Then, an hour later, another house in nearby Hallwood went up. That was 6 fires in less than 30 hours. If the county was whispering before, they were in outright panic now. At this time, I'm going to pause so we can hear a word from our sponsors. The morning after the series of six fires, County Sheriff Todd Godwin met with the state arson investigators. The county didn't have their own, so the state was automatically called in. They quickly deemed all of the fires to be incendiary, meaning that they were lit on purpose. It was official. Accomack County had a serial arsonist on its hands. They had already had one years earlier. David Clifton Parks, a volunteer firefighter and a well-liked man, turned into a violent man once he had a few drinks. He soon started lighting fires and quickly moved on to Maryland, where he was caught. He was in the Jessup Correctional Institute and couldn't possibly be responsible for these new fires. Investigators wondered if the series of fires was a one-off. Had whoever started them gotten it out of their system? They quickly realized this was only the beginning, as the county was to burn almost every night for 5 months straight after this first string of fires. Sheriff Todd Godwin had been on high alert after the first three fires. Like many locals, and especially as sheriff, he was protective of his county. He was well-liked, an elected official who was known to be a hard worker. Always on duty, he had some polo shirts stitched with the word sheriff for when he was technically off the clock. But he was never really off the clock. His county, though not densely populated, was large, and he had a lot of area to look over. Before the fires, he had been troubled by graffiti. Now, in big cities, graffiti is obviously more commonplace, but it's not like it's unheard of in rural areas. But it was clear that the graffiti in his county was connected. Starting the summer before, someone was spray-painting graffiti on abandoned houses all over the county, but seemed to be targeting a local couple, Jay Floyd and his girlfriend Danielle. They were called narcs, and in many different profane ways. Whoever was doing the spray painting seemed to think the couple were police informants. When the sixth fire was called in, the caller had even identified the building as one of the Jay Narc houses. Well, at least that was one less tagged house, is what Godwin had thought to himself, but he was wondering if this wasn't all connected. Serial crimes of any sort were unusual in Accomack County, but the graffiti and fire seemed to be happening in all the same places and always in the cover of night. And yet, as soon as the fire started, the graffiti stopped. The first thing Sheriff Godwin did was to make a list of potential targets for state investigators. He requested a roster of abandoned houses on record in Accomack. The list had over 800 houses on it. And this might be a small estimate because these were only properties that someone was still paying taxes on. It didn't include houses deep in the woods or marshes, and the investigators were aware that there were probably actually thousands of potential targets. With manpower pulled from local police stations and the state, they were able to get about 8 to 10 volunteers a night to watch some of the houses. So they would have 5 teams on stakeout every night. Obviously, they had to narrow this list way down. First, they cut it down to houses with easy access roads. Then even further to houses with multiple access points and not on dead-end roads. In the end, they chose 5 houses around the county. Number 6 was in Keller, and it was just as good a candidate as any, but got edged out. The investigators reasoned that they had to start somewhere. The 2-man teams had camouflaged tents and portable heaters as the winter chill was setting in. Every night, they snuck in at dusk and didn't leave until first light. And every morning, they left dismayed that yet another fire had struck somewhere else. Fire number 28 was that 6th house on the list in Keller. Everyone was exhausted and frustrated. They couldn't be everywhere at once. They needed to start narrowing in on suspects instead of just watching potential targets. This was the sticky part of the investigation. As you may have already guessed, firefighters are always some of the first suspects. Indeed, as I mentioned earlier, the only other Accomack arsonist had been a volunteer firefighter. And that would mean a large pool of men and women to question all over the county. Instead, the investigators, with the help of the state police and the FBI, created a questionnaire designed to first put the person filling it out at ease. Simple, easy questions. Why do you volunteer? How long have you been a volunteer? Etc. Then the questions would become more of a psychological and subtle personality interrogation. Naturally, many of the volunteer firefighters wadded up the questionnaire and refused to even participate. It's not like they had a lot of spare time on their hands either. The fires were happening so frequently that most volunteers stopped going home to sleep. Though the local stations were not generally set up with sleeping quarters, they all threw together some makeshift bunks, using sleeping bags when they had to. Firefighters might catch a few hours of sleep and then jump up and back on the truck for the next call. Some chose just to stay awake, jittery with caffeine and stress. As Washington Post columnist Monica Hesse put it, arson is a weird crime. She first wrote a long article on the Accomack story after the suspects were caught. She requested a leave of absence from the paper to move to the county and do research for her book. I'll tell you more about the book later in the episode, as well as in the show notes. But she points out that even though arson is weird, it's much more common than most of us realize. It's because, frankly, unlike murder, arson just isn't a sexy crime. What most people don't understand, though, is that arson is kind of like a gateway drug. Many serial killers start off as arsonists. David Berkowitz lit over 1,400 fires, according to his journals, and he was actually caught over a fire. When he lit a blaze near his home, one of his neighbors told the cops they thought they ought to look into him for his odd behavior. And arson certainly isn't a new crime. There are references to arson in the Bible and many ancient texts. But the study of arson is one that is continuously evolving. But starting in the 1700s, scholars of the day decided that most arsonists were young peasant women, perhaps hysterical with the onset of their first menses. Today, we find this fairly hilarious for many reasons, not the least of which is the idea that a woman on her period is a danger to society. But also, modern studies show that most arsonists are men. And they aren't just white men. As Harries points out in her book, white arsonists hit white neighborhoods, black arsonists set fires in black neighborhoods. You get the idea. The studies do show, however, that arsonists generally have a lower IQ than normal, and many have substance abuse issues or suffer from other mental disorders like schizophrenia. However, the study of female arsonists do show they have different motivations. Women that light fires tend to do so out of revenge, and they are more likely to set fires to places they have an emotional connection with. But studies will vary wildly, with one showing that 35% of arsonists are women, and another saying that 4% are. In our ever-evolving studies, we also need to do better at factoring in the motives and capabilities of the so-called fairer sex. It is important to note that while arson is a crime, it isn't always part of a mental disorder. What we would call pyromania is actually rather rare. There are lots of logical reasons, or at least understandable reasons, that people start fires. To collect on insurance would be the most obvious. And that would have nothing to do with mental illness. But the Center for Arson Research does categorize arsonists. There are the experimental, who are often children that do it once and never again. Then there are the mentally ill, those who hear voices telling them to start fires. They often converge with the communicative fire setters, those that use fire to send a message. Though again, that is not always necessarily a sign of mental illness, since I'm sure we've all seen at least one mob movie where they torch a place in order to send a message. And, unfortunately, the stereotype of the firefighter starting fires is actually true. It's so they can run out and be the hero. These would be in the thrill-seeking category. And of course, you've also got the criminal subset who are starting fires to hide another crime. None of these fire setters are what psychiatrists consider true pyromaniacs. True pyromaniacs never have a reason. There's no voice telling them to do it. They do it for the thrill. They do it because they are aroused by the fire. They are excited by it. And so it becomes a compulsion. In the end, we often just can't find a good reason. Some people just light fires to see something burn. As Ray Bradbury wrote in Fahrenheit 451, "It was a pleasure to burn. It was a special pleasure to see things eaten, to see things blackened and changed. Now that I've given you a rundown on some of the typical motives of arsonists and pyromaniacs, I think it's time to get to the fire setters in Accomack County, Virginia, Charlie Smith and Tanya Bundick. Charles Smith III, also known as Charlie Applegate, which was his stepfather's last name, was a born screw-up. He was a genial guy, well-liked, he just always had problems. His father left when he was still a baby, and his mother married George Applegate when he was still very young. George was good to his stepchildren, and many people who didn't know the family well thought that Charlie was his biological son. George was a mechanic and taught Charlie to fix cars as well. He hoped it would give the boy a vocation once it became obvious that Charlie had issues. He was also a volunteer firefighter, and he brought Charlie into the tradition with the Tasley Fire Department, along with his son Brian. Charlie joined the crew on his 12th birthday. In November of 2012, Charlie was a 38-year-old man who never finished high school. He'd quit in the 9th grade. He had a drug habit for many years, smoking pot as a kid, but graduating to cocaine and then crack as an adult. He'd also done time in prison. In his late teens and early 20s, he was creating so many problems at home that he moved in with an uncle and promptly stole his checkbook. He was charged with dozens of counts of forgery and was sentenced to 3 years, though he was able to get most of that time suspended. In prison, he got clean, got out, and got right back on drugs, and now moved up the criminal chain to robbery. After he got out of prison this time, he checked in regularly with his probation officer, who couldn't help but like Charlie. At least when he screwed up, he told the truth. He'd come in and say, "Don't bother with the drug test, you'll find crack in my system." In between his prison stints, Charlie fathered a little girl. He adored her and offered marriage to her mother, who declined. But he showed up for every school play, every recital, every game. He paid what child support he could and tried to stay in his daughter's life as much as possible. After his second round in prison, he took a job in one of the poultry plants to help support his daughter. He met a woman named Mary, and they were soon in a relationship. It was the first real relationship of his life. They both had drug and alcohol issues, but together they committed to attending AA and NA meetings. And Charlie went back to working with his stepfather and also soon became a volunteer firefighter again. He loved being a firefighter. He took great pride in his position. And even though Charlie had a criminal record, he was given second and third chances. Like I said, he was a well-liked man, someone who was always seen more as a messy guy than a hardened criminal. So he was always welcomed back to the Tasley Department, along with his stepfather and half-brother Brian. Charlie and Mary were together for about a decade, but the relationship fizzled out before they ever married. There weren't any real hard feelings. Neither had remained all that faithful, and they mutually agreed to split. Mary wound up moving to mainland Virginia, and Charlie stayed on the Eastern Shore. But after he split with Mary, the tenuous hold he had on sobriety came to an end. It started with the death of a favorite uncle, and then his mother became ill. This was devastating to Charlie, because no matter what he did, his mother always loved him and believed in him. And despite George Applegate's kindness, Charlie always felt like an outsider. His mother was his last hold to his family, and he was distraught at the thought of losing her. This was the Charlie Smith who strolled into a bar called Shuckers one night in 2011. He had 2 8-balls of cocaine on him and wasn't sure what he was going to do. He felt suicidal and had already picked up a gun once and put it to his head, but was unable to pull the trigger. On this night, he thought, maybe he would OD, or maybe he'd just get blasted and forget his problems. And it was on this night that Tanya Bundick happened to talk to him. He had seen her before. She was a striking, vivacious woman, 40 years old, in great shape, and always dressed provocatively. Oddly, she could get away with it. Any other woman dressed this way would likely be called a hussy or otherwise sneered at, but not Tanya. Tanya was popular. She was exciting. She danced on tabletops. And other women loved her, too. She had that kind of magnetic charm that drew people to her, though she often kept them at arm's length. It was a running joke that she never had to buy a drink, but then again, other women seemed to admire her. They weren't jealous. Charlie was terrified of her. He had never spoken to her before, though he'd seen her there many times. Tanya was also a native of Accomack County. The Bundick family name traced back to a colonist who arrived in 1647. But like Charlie, she had grown up as an outcast. She was born and raised just north of Parksley, and as a girl, she'd worn huge round eyeglasses. She was bullied daily, most often on the school bus, which she rode several times a day. Tanya was enrolled in a program similar to Future Farmers of America called Health Occupations Student Association. The group took regular classes in the morning, and then in the afternoons, they were bused to take classes in home health care. They graduated high school already certified as nursing assistants. Students in these programs were usually there for practical reasons. Their families would never be able to afford college, and they expected to start working as soon as they left school. This program, like FFA, helped them get a leg up so they weren't headed straight into waiting tables or retail jobs. But Tanya wasn't just being realistic. She found inspiration from her mother, Susan, who had been a nurse before she married. Susan was a lovely woman and the sort of friend and neighbor that everyone thought highly of, even if they didn't know her that well. She wasn't able to get to know many people very well. Tanya's father, Carol, made that difficult for all of them. As her sister Angie would later reveal, he beat her and Tanya and their mother severely. And they were also desperately poor. There was never enough to eat, never money to do anything fun, never new clothes, though their mother was adept with a sewing machine. The girls lived a hardscrabble life. But in hindsight, Angie saw that her sister was tougher. She was her protector, and Tanya stood up to her own bullies as well, often fighting those twice her size, never crying, never giving up, never showing weakness. She did become a nursing assistant when she graduated from high school. She moved to Chincoteague Island and soon became pregnant by a local landscaper. He was African American, and even in the late 90s, with over a fourth of the county black, Accomack citizens still judged her and her son. She wound up having another son with him, but the couple never married, and she soon took her kids and moved back to East Shore without him. She took another nursing job, this time in a home for the mentally disabled. She was much admired by her co-workers. She was a hard worker and never shied away from the more unpleasant aspects of nursing. But still, it didn't pay well. She barely made $15,000 a year and often complained that the boys' fathers didn't pay child support. But somehow she made it work. She was known to be a great single mom. The type that always baked homemade cupcakes and always showed up for her kids' school events. Her boys did not wear clothes from Walmart or Goodwill. No matter what she had to sacrifice, they wore clothes from a nice department store. In 2006, her mother Susan suddenly died, collapsing in her own backyard, probably from a heart attack. Tanya was the one to find her. Her father had died a few years earlier, and Tanya moved into their house with her sons. She had an arrangement with her sister Angie, as the house had been left to both of them. Angie would sell her share for $1, and later, when their aging grandmother passed away, Tanya would do the same and Angie would inherit that house. With at least the burden of not having to make rent taken off of her, Tanya started to get out more. People in town took notice of the pretty single mother. She stood out for her tan alone. Tanya was known to visit multiple tanning salons in one day, to the point that she was almost orange-colored. But with her carefully applied makeup, her perfect hairdo, and her stylish clothes, Tanya made it work. And she became a regular at Shucker's, where finally, she was the popular girl, no longer hungry and no longer wearing the wrong clothes. Now her clothes, makeup, and tan were her armor, and she blossomed into a happier woman. Or at least, that's what people thought of her, the side that she showed of herself. This was the Tanya that Charlie finally talked to that fateful night in 2011. They were introduced by friends. The friends were Jay Floyd and his girlfriend, Danielle. If those names are familiar, it's because they were the targets of the graffiti vandals that had so plagued Sheriff Godwin before the arsons began. Turns out, though the couple had introduced Charlie and Tanya, they soon changed their minds and were not supportive of the relationship. Supposedly, Danielle didn't think Charlie was good enough for Tanya, which, frankly, Charlie would probably agree with. There is no indication that they were informants for the police or anything like that. Understanding Tanya's motives may shed more light on why they focused their ire so adamantly on Jay and Danielle. Tanya's sister Angie spoke later with the lead prosecutor and gave a bit more insight into Tanya's personality, even though it seems like she was a mystery to her own sister. It was Angie who provided the details about Tanya's childhood, the extreme poverty, the abusive father, the bullying from schoolmates, and Tanya's resulting isolation. Angie said though Tanya was often her protector outside of the home, Angie often tried to take the blame in front of their father because Tanya was so tiny. But Angie ran away when she was 18 years old, escaping that miserable home as soon as she could. She said she did not see Tanya again until their father died. I may be projecting here, but considering what happened next, I think Tanya felt deserted by her sister, left to fend for herself. After their mother died, Angie did visit home more often. Angie said that she once caught Tanya kissing her boyfriend. She was understandably angry and confronted Tanya, but she also criticized her appearance, something that Tanya had been touchy about her whole life. She told her that her clothing was inappropriate and that she shouldn't go out dressed that way. She pretty much told her she was disgracing herself as a mother. This caused a huge screaming match. Tanya told Angie that the deal was off. She would not sign over their grandmother's home to her. She told her, quote, "I'll burn it down before I sign over those papers." Angie tried to chalk this up to their terrible childhood. She herself had left, gotten extensive therapy, and dealt with her demons. Tanya hadn't. Angie left, went back to her own life and children, hoping time would heal the fracture with her sister. But a year later, Tanya sent her a picture of their grandmother's home burning. It was one of the 66 homes they destroyed. In all, they wound up setting over 80 fires. In the months leading up to the fires, Charlie and Tanya's relationship was changing. They insisted they were happy and put on a big front. Charlie even proposed. Tanya was not happy with his private, though earnest, proposal. A month or so later, she had him propose to her at Shucker's, taking the stage and the microphone. They had worn matching yellow outfits and brought a cake. Appearances mattered to Tanya. It's something that becomes a theme with the people in her life. She couldn't stand criticism, whether it was about her appearance or what people thought of her life choices. It's hard to reconcile this with the confident barfly and skimpy clothing at Shucker's. But from her sister's story to Jay and Danielle's, it would seem that Tanya could not stand it when others didn't approve of her. Charlie later admitted that they did do all the graffiti, that it had been Tanya's idea, but he didn't mind. He even thought it was fun. They would go to Walmart and pick up the spray paint and then ride around looking for deserted places to tag, and always tagging Jay and Danielle. Tanya may have been mad at the world, but for a while she was focused on former friends who had dared to judge her relationship. This riding around to blow off steam became something the couple did a lot, and they had a lot on their minds. Charlie's mother had finally passed away from cancer in May of 2012, and he was a shattered man. He felt as though he had no real family left. And Tanya felt the same way after she cut her sister out of her life. Now they were each other's family. Tanya was also troubled about her oldest son, who had always had a learning disability, but now it was severe enough that she'd had to take him out of school and homeschool him. The stress of her money was gnawing at her. But they were still planning their wedding. They had decided the theme would be like the Guns N' Roses video, November Rain. Perhaps an odd choice, as the unhappy bride in that video dies in the end. but it's what they wanted. Tanya wanted a lavish wedding and had picked out a dress costing thousands. So now, Charlie was stressing about money. He was constantly looking for extra work, and now his friends were starting to try and make him see that Tanya wasn't good for him. But he would have none of it. She was the love of his life. If she wanted a big fancy wedding, then by God, he would give it to her. And there was something else. Something that no one knew. Something that caused them both shame. Charlie had become impotent. Later, in his confessions to Sheriff Godwin, he said it was like his dick just stopped working the day he fell in love with Tanya. Had their sex life been non-existent all along? For a couple so possessive and so demonstratively in love, this seems so bizarre. Everyone described them as lovey-dovey. They even shared a Facebook profile. But maybe because of his sexual issues, he would do anything to keep Tanya happy. He saw doctors that told him it was all in his head. Charlie later would say he always thought she was too good for him. Maybe he was intimidated. Tanya agreed in a later interview, saying he psyched himself out no matter how much she tried to reassure him. By the time they were caught for the fires, they hadn't had sex in over a year. But he loved her desperately, and she said she loved him too. After all, they were all each other had. But even as close as they were, Charlie admitted that Tanya put up a wall. There was always a place that he could not get to. The same sentiment was shared by her sister, friends, and even a high school boyfriend. Tanya was hard to know. She put on a cheerful, vivacious front, but she would not show weakness. Perhaps she couldn't show it. So one November night, as they're riding around, talking about their troubles, Charlie mentions that he would do anything to make her happy. She stopped the truck and looked at him, then looked over at an abandoned house on Dennis Drive and said, "Will you burn that house down for me?" At first he thought she was joking, but then she sat there and waited. He later said he got out of the truck and walked around and pretended to start a fire, and then ran back to the truck. When she asked him if it was started, he said yes, and they drove away quickly. But like many arsonists, Tanya needed to see the flames. She drove back to Dennis Drive and was aggravated when she saw it wasn't burning. She hopped out of the truck and lit the fire herself. And so it began. Charlie would later confess that Tanya herself started the first 11 or so fires. He only took over when she was almost caught. At one of the houses, a police patrol car drove by, and he was sure they would be found. She got away with it, but from then on, he insisted on lighting the fires. He pointed out that first of all, as a firefighter, he knew what he was doing. But more importantly, he loved her. And if they were caught, he would be happy to take the blame. Criminal couples always capture the public's imagination in America. There's a reason they remake a Bonnie and Clyde movie every few years. Psychologists over the years have had a field day trying to figure them out, and a popular trope is the idea of folie à deux, or the madness of two, that they are both suffering from a shared mental illness. Modern psychiatric studies show that there are many different reasons why couples embark on their crimes together. But most psychiatrists agree with what Dr. Joni Johnston wrote in Psychology Today. Quote, "Most duos consist of a dominant person who teams up with an equally enthusiastic accomplice, or someone who, because something is lacking in their own character, is easy to bring on board." This really seems to sum up the love story of Charlie and Tanya. I don't think there's anyone who could doubt that Tanya was the dominant partner. In fact, Charlie was considered a fairly passive and easygoing man before he even met her. He was someone that was susceptible to a stronger personality. He often spoke of how she was so much smarter than him. Ironically, it would be Tanya's mistake that would get them caught. After burning up some 65 houses, they went quiet for a bit. Authorities had been worried about an old derelict hotel called Whispering Pines. They felt it was a dangerous target. But so far, the arsonists seemed to stick to smaller, out-of-the-way places. So they set up cameras at several of the potential targets, as they could only stake out 5 places at a time. One night, they finally caught a break. The camera barely caught it, but once the building was on fire, a figure ran back out into the road, which was out of the camera's range. Though it was in the shadows, the figure was clearly a woman. Authorities kept this in their back pocket, but did start to wonder if they were dealing with a couple. They had for some time believed it was a pair of arsonists, one to light the fire and one to drive the getaway car. And maybe if Charlie and Tanya had stopped after fire number 66, they could have gotten away with it. Whispering Pines would have been quite the finale. It burned for days, causing over $300,000 worth of damage. It was also a symbol of the once prosperous eastern shore of Virginia, built back in the early 1900s when farmers were kings and the rich and bored came to see the beautiful shores of Virginia. But they didn't stop. I think Tanya may well be a true pyromaniac. I think she liked the control. She was active in Facebook groups about the arsons, always saying that whoever was lighting the fires was way too smart to be caught. I think she liked being the smartest. And I think she just liked to see things burn. On April Fool's Day of 2013, Tanya chose a dilapidated house on Airport Drive in Melpha. Charlie immediately felt hinky about the place. He thought it was an obvious choice and was probably being watched. But Tanya insisted, and as always, he did as he was told. But this time, Charlie was right. 2 state troopers were watching the house. It was on the potential target list. At around 11:30, they saw a gold minivan pull up. They saw a man dart over to the dark house, and then they saw sparks flying. They had to wait, though. They had to wait for the house to actually catch fire if they were going to make the charges stick. When it finally did, they watched the man run back out to the road, but the van was gone. They started to chase him when suddenly the van reappeared back out of the woods. They watched him jump into the passenger side, and then the van took off. The troopers radioed in, and soon every cop car in the county was swarming the area. Sergeant Wayne Greer had the honor of pulling over the notorious arsonists. Neither were talking much. Finally, when Sheriff Todd Godwin arrived on scene, Charlie saw his old friend of 20 years and broke down. He said, "Todd, I'm sorry, but I didn't like them all." They were taken in for questioning, and the police were soon met with completely opposite personalities. Charlie confessed, recanted, cried, confessed again. He insisted he wanted to take all the blame. He kept saying he didn't light the first few fires, but refused to say who, even though now it was obvious. He just couldn't do it. All he wanted to do was make sure Tanya was okay, and he was fine with taking the rap for all of it. He openly asked the police what he could do to make sure she would be okay. Tanya, on the other hand, sold him out so fast it'd make your head spin. She claimed Charlie lit all the fires, that he was a drug addict, that he had mental issues. But she also claimed she didn't know he was the arsonist until they were arrested. She said that Charlie worked long, strange hours, and he would just call her to pick him up. This was not the greatest cover story, considering that he had his own truck, and she owned 2 vehicles herself. Tanya was only charged with 1 count of arson and 1 count of conspiracy. They could only get her on the last fire, the one where she got caught. All because Charlie Smith loved her so much he refused to testify against her. Charlie was charged with 67 counts of arson and 1 count of conspiracy to commit arson. He quickly pled guilty, but he would not be sentenced right away. First, they needed him to testify against Tanya. This was proving to be a difficult task. He loved her. He said he would never testify against her. So the 2 sat in jail. Tanya's trial had been moved to Virginia Beach. Before it started, she did everything she could to influence Charlie through secret jailhouse maneuvers, but also through letters. She didn't write directly to him, but through other people. She wanted them to get married. She was savvy enough to know that married couples couldn't testify against each other. The problem was, those weren't the only letters she wrote. Through a jailhouse pen pal service, she had started writing another man. Love letters. Or to be more exact, the letters were erotic and very explicit. Finally, Godwin and the lead prosecutor showed the letters to Charlie. As smart as Tanya was, she forgot that all outgoing mail was monitored. A heartbroken Charlie finally gave the full story. He had done it for her. It was all for her, and she just needed it for some reason. "I just couldn't let her down," he said. "I mean, her son had just torn her to pieces. She don't hit her kids, she don't yell at them, she didn't do drugs, she didn't have any outlets." Tanya, who had finally gotten out on bond, was rearrested and charged with 66 counts of arson in addition to what she'd already been charged with. At Tanya's first trial, Charlie's testimony was heartbreaking. He cried often, still professed his undying love for her, despite her betrayal. Tanya sat there with stony resolve. Proving that the two had been communicating the night of the fire and had done it together. Another important factor that came out in trial, the Valentine's Day fire at J.D. Shears that I opened the story with. Well, he was an old beau of Tanya's, and she still resented how he had broken up with her. This was more than 2 years after they had dated, and Shears had no idea she could hate him this much. Like Jay and Danielle, the reaction Tanya had to the perceived slight was completely out of proportion. When the jury left to deliberate, Tanya's lawyer talked her into a plea before they returned with a verdict. She took an Alford plea, which is basically where you admit nothing but acknowledge that the prosecution probably has enough to convict you. For this, she received a 3-year term. After this, the DA and the rest of the county officials hoped Tanya would plead out to the rest of the charges. But she didn't. She doubled down and went forward with the second trial. Her lawyer insisted that the charges be split up, that she couldn't possibly get a fair trial if a jury saw that many charges. The judge agreed, and the county geared up for the years of trials that lay ahead. Virginia State Police began estimating how much time and money had been spent hunting down the arsonists, and they found that 26,378 regular work hours and 14,924 overtime hours had been used. They had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on lodging, food, and aviation expenses alone. This didn't even factor in what the county had spent fighting almost 80 fires. While Tanya and Charlie had only been charged with 67, the fire departments had been called out 86 times. Not all were for buildings, and many were thought to be opportunistic, someone using the arsonist to get rid of their own properties and collect insurance money. One truly staggering figure from all of this is the number of people that were hurt or killed by Tanya and Charlie's 5-month rampage. 0. No one was injured. The county was no doubt terrorized and lived in a constant state of fear, but no one ever actually got hurt. Charlie always insisted that they never wanted to hurt anyone, and in the end, no one was ever physically injured. Tanya Bundick was found guilty at her second trial. She was given 7 more years. After this, she finally agreed to take an Alford plea for the rest of the charges. In all, she was sentenced to 17 years in prison. To this day, she denies any involvement in setting the fires. She still blames it all on Charlie. Charlie was sentenced to 15 years after the judge waited to finally sentence Tanya. He wanted their time to be equitable, and Charlie had spent more time in jail already than she had. And even though Tanya would never admit to being the arsonist responsible for the reign of terror over Accomack County, someone self-published a book on Amazon called Burning. It was a supposedly fictional account of a pair of arsonists named Sonia Boonswick and Harley. In the book, Sonia is framed for Harley's crimes. The book was published anonymously and was never proven to have been written by Tanya. But many point to details in the book that line up too closely with what really happened, and most people believe she did pen the book. Perhaps still desperately hoping to make the world believe that Charlie was the real pyromaniac. But no one believes this. Charlie has been painfully honest in not only court testimony, but in all interviews. He agreed to sit down with Monica Hesse for her book, American Fire, Love, Arson, and Life in a Vanishing Land. Tanya spoke with the author once, but then refused to cooperate at all. But Hesse found much cooperation in Accomack County. Her book is incredible. It is as much about the changing culture of rural Virginia as it is about the lovelorn arsonist that sought to burn it down. I definitely recommend reading it if you're interested in learning more about this case. It's funny, when I came across this story, I had planned for this to be a shorter episode. I didn't think a string of 80-some-odd fires would be all that interesting to write about or to hear. But the love story of Charlie and Tanya, and the research into arson and what motivates someone to compulsively set fires, was enthralling to me. The fact that Tanya to this day denies the arson and refuses all interviews only makes her more mysterious and compelling. Author Laura Esquivel wrote, "Each of us is born with a box of matches inside us, but we can't strike them all by ourselves." Using fire as a metaphor for love dates back to ancient times. There's a reason why words like sparked, smoldering, and burning feel so right to say when we're trying to explain something as complex as love or passion. These are feelings. You can't see them, and yet they are all-consuming, much like a fire. They suck up the air around you, overwhelm you, and sometimes they can destroy you. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. As always, if you enjoyed the show, tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I know iTunes is a pain, but it's still the best way for others to find Southern Fried, so I really appreciate your help. I'm also on Stitcher and many other apps. If you're interested in supporting the show, come check out my Patreon page. And I've also recently updated my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, to include a donate option if you would like to make just a one-time donation. I also have some fantastic merch now. Visit my shop at whatamaneuver.net to check it out. They have t-shirts, tanks, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing Burning Love or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my main Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.